Hello and welcome to The Chirp, where we chat with creative minds working with Keene State. I'm Andrew Michaud, and today I have with me the director of Pang. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi everybody, my name is Dan Frood. It's nice to talk to you, Andrew.
It's nice to talk to you as well, Dan. So I noticed on your website, it mentions you have about 30 years of performance and creation experience. What started that passion?
Oh my goodness. Well, I don't know. I have just always been interested in performance ever since I was, before I can remember. I do trace back my current inspiration to a moment when I was a street musician in Boston, when somebody passed me by and then turned around and came back and listened for a while. And I thought, that's what performance can do. It can connect people. And I've been hooked ever since then.
Oh, yeah, that's our neck of the woods, Boston. Excellent. What kind of performances did you do on the streets in Boston?
I was a saxophonist. I was a street musician. Played solo and hooked up with different people at different times.
I always love seeing those walking around the city. It always makes the day a little more exciting.
Yeah, it really does. It makes it a village.
Absolutely, absolutely. So your website also lists a whirlwind of different roles that you've played in the past. I saw performance artist, producer, writer, composer, dancer, saxophonist, as you mentioned, monologuist, and even the department chair and professor at UCLA. What stands out as the most important to you, if any one thing does?
Probably father. I have twins who are 20 years old, and that has been, I would say, the greatest role of my life.
I'm sure your kid would agree.
Hopefully both.
Hopefully both. You have quite a few shows and other various styles of performance under your belt, such as dance, singing, and even puppetry. Which one of those mediums is your favorite, and what got you into that medium to begin with?
I wouldn't say that I have a favorite medium. The only constant is change, and so I'm always interested in trying and learning new things. But I do feel like dance is the discipline that is the most adventurous. And so I keep coming back to dance, not necessarily as a dancer myself all the time, but the sort of the discipline of dance in terms of compositional methods and the ways that dance thinks about performance and the connection to the audience in ways that music and theater and other forms of performance don't necessarily do.
So bringing it up to the present a little bit with Pang, and that is Pang with an exclamation point. That's an interesting name. What is the inspiration behind that?
Well, the show, Pang, is a series of radio plays that are based on the oral histories of families around the country who are living with food insecurity. So Pang, P-A-N-G, is both a sound effect, and that's why the exclamation point, and a hunger pang. So it sort of unifies those two ideas. We're interested in learning what hunger sounds like in America.
What hunger sounds like in America. All right, I like that. You just mentioned that the name itself is actually based off a sound effect in part. I watched a few of your videos on past performances, and there's quite an influence on those old-fashioned sound effects, like the Folly Pit and things like that. What started that interest in that? What do you think it adds over the things that are less intensive, such as a simple soundboard that could produce similar noises?
Sure. It's a great question. Well, one thing that we're interested in with this show was creating a gap between what audiences see and hear. So you see a bunch of actors standing at microphones, reading their scripts, and also doing some of those old-fashioned sound effects, like you say, squishing a sponge for people walking through a wet cornfield, or a small prop door opening and closing every time somebody leaves the room. And it's the audience's job to take what they see and what they hear and fill in the gap in between. And that is work that an audience does, and that work is in the form of empathy. They have to cast themselves into the story and imagine it for themselves. And that's the position that we want the audience in. We sort of want them between the ears, as it were, of the families themselves whose stories we're portraying.
Between the ears, that was another thing that I saw come up quite often when I was doing some of my research. So would you say getting between the ears of these people is your one of your main goals with this showcase?
I think so, metaphorically, in the sense that we want to try to decrease stigma when it comes to food insecurity. We want to decrease the stigma of being food insecure so that stigma doesn't stand in the way of accessing support or resources. And we want to decrease the stigma for people who don't consider themselves to be food insecure and might judge people who do use those resources. So we're hoping to bring together diverse folks within communities who might be on either side of that socioeconomic divide to get to know each other a little bit better.
So the kitchen table idea of your stage play is a pretty unique addition, I think. And that's a nice way to include the audience in the story. Why is it important to you that the audience take part in these stories like that? And could you describe for the audience a little bit what that kitchen table philosophy is?
Absolutely. We do two versions of the live performance. One is the full version, and that's what folks are going to see, at least on Wednesday and Thursday night. They'll see pre-recorded performance of the full version of two of those plays, the Los Angeles play and the Cedar Rapids play. And on Friday night, we may or may not be able to perform a live version of the play, depending on the availability of one of our cast members. Otherwise, we will play a pre-recorded version of that on Friday. So, the kitchen table. When we do the unplugged version of Pang, which is without the musicians, without a lot of the sound effects, sort of like a chamber version of it, more intimate and sort of direct for the audience, we have on one side of the stage, literally a kitchen table with 6 to 8 chairs sitting there. And there are 6 to 8 people at the kitchen table the entire time while we're performing on the other side of the stage. They're watching the performance. They have some snacks, they have some food, and some drinks on the table. And there are mics on the table as well that you can't quite see. And towards the end of the performance, we're interacting with the folks at the kitchen table. And they start to have a dialogue of their own about the performance and what it might mean to their community, just among themselves, those 6 to 8 people. We sort of disappear, we go away, and the community, represented by these 6 to 8 people at the table, begin to have this dialogue together. And soon that opens up to the entire auditorium, and the goal is to get everybody talking with each other. Not a Q&A with the artists, but a dialogue among community members. And we're going to do that in our own way with this online performance. And people will just have to come and see how that's done.
And so just to clarify, those 6 to 8 people that are up there at the kitchen table, those are audience members, correct?
They're audience members. Before the shows, we are out in the audience welcoming people, introducing ourselves. And in the course of doing that, we invite 6 or 8 folks up on stage with us. And throughout the course of the performance, if anybody wants to leave the kitchen table, go back to their seat, they're welcome to. Anybody who wants to come up and fill that seat, they're welcome to. Actually, you know what, Andrew, usually at the end of a performance, by the time we get to the third play, more people keep coming up on stage. So we always have extra chairs off stage to accommodate. And sometimes we have as many as 15 people around the table.
Impressive. That must mean it's actually really working.
Hopefully, you know, we try to make ourselves as welcoming as possible.
Well, you touched upon this a little bit already, but as an integral part of the show, what does the COVID kitchen table look like? Better, worse, just different? Or would you rather people find that out for themselves by attending?
Well, frankly, we're going to find that out for ourselves. This is the first time we've tried it. We had initially thought we would simulate the kitchen table by putting everybody in the audience into breakout rooms of 6 or 8 people. But then we thought that's more isolating than, you know, than a communal situation. Even though people would have a chance to talk to each other in that smaller group, we decided to trade off that intimacy for staying in the large Zoom room. And we have some ways of inviting people to feel like they can contribute to the dialogue. And also, Zoom has the added feature of the chat function, which is a little bit less intimidating, we find, than speaking out loud in front of a group. We expect that after spending some time with folks in Keene this week, we expect that there will be some people who will feel pretty comfortable about contributing.
I'm glad to hear that. I certainly hope so. Well, is there any part of the performance that you are particularly looking forward to seeing people's reactions to?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, one thing is that an almost universal reaction, Andrew, is when we speak with people afterwards, they say, I had no idea what this was going to be. You know, my husband dragged me here, and I don't even know what a radio play is. And I could not take my eyes off you guys the whole time. You know, I think the experience is so novel that people really don't know what to expect. So I think it's the radio play format that we're not really used to and at first might seem very disorienting, but pretty much universally, the response from people was they found it incredibly engaging.
So what did encourage you to make this a radio performance rather than a simple stage play, a mock-up of television even? Why that specific brand of broadcast?
It's a great question. You know, it has to do with that theory of the gap between what you see and what you hear and our desire for audiences to be in an empathic position relative to the stories that they're hearing. I also wanted to make sure that nobody had the opportunity to confuse an actor with a character. We've got, you know, three brilliant actors, and I really wanted the audience to participate in creating the character. And so they need to do that by visualizing the character. And I think one of the things that we do with the actors is they play a lot of different characters, a lot of different voices. And so you can't really assign any one actor to a particular character. You have to hold those characters in your head and in your heart as you're watching the performance. And I think that's what's so engaging, frankly. I also, just one more thing about this, I'm also a composer, and the opportunity to think about a play as sound was really, really exciting and challenging to me. So I wanted to try that as well.
So that is interesting, because you said dance was one of your, maybe not your favorite, but one you kept going back to. So that's interesting. Did not having that visual component as much challenge you in ways that were unexpected?
Yes, in a way. You know, I became concerned. I mean, there is a visual component, and I became concerned that that was too static in a way. And so we added some parts where people are switching microphones and moving around the stage for functional reasons. And that helped a little bit, but then I also began to feel and feel now that just being able to concentrate on the simple act of somebody reading a script in this day and age with the sort of velocity of images coming at us, this really allows us to zero in on a character and a story and a narrative in a way that I find really engaging.
As we're coming to the end here, my last question for you, if there is one thing that you could tell the world about this type of art, this type of performing, what would it be?
Expect the unexpected, I think. One of the things that we discovered and that was unexpected for us when we entered into this project is that the plays ended up not being about food insecurity in any direct way, as we might have expected them to be. So one play is about the plight of refugees trying to resettle in a new culture. Another play is about a family dispossessed of their home. Another play is about a family that experiences gun violence. None of these are intrinsically about food insecurity, but all of these families are living with food insecurity. And what we discovered is, at least for the families that we've been working with, food insecurity is nearly invisible. It's a daily irritant, maybe, but these other issues are really in people's faces and urgent on a day-to-day basis. Whereas food insecurity, you know, there are so many people in my family, some of the older kids have to occasionally skip a meal in order for the younger kids to eat, you know. Well, that's just the way it is, but where are we going to live? Because, you know, we're losing our home. You know, the farm is failing. We don't have enough money for rent. You know, we're going to live on rice for a week. Well, that's the way it is. Where are we going to, how are we going to make money now? So those kinds of issues are the ones that are completely enmeshed with food insecurity, though. I mean, food insecurity is implicated in immigration. It's implicated in gun violence. It's implicated in foreclosure. We chose to, and the families chose, to tell these stories that felt more present in their lives than food insecurity did. And so that became our thesis, that food insecurity tends to disappear behind all of these other more visible issues in people's lives. And it still is working its way insidiously in their lives and making it more difficult to function in civic life, in education, in work life, and we don't see it as much. So something we're trying to do is to draw awareness towards it.
Oh, thank you very much, Dan. It's been a pleasure. I wish you and your crew the best of luck on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and have a fantastic night.
Thank you. Hope to see a lot of folks there at 6 o'clock on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday this week through the Redfern Center for the Arts.
Thank you for listening to The Chirp. Music provided by composer Nathaniel Bridges. See you next time.